If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Mike Ray, former cop and body double for a world-famous action star, was ready to put show business behind him when he was asked to do one last favor for Hollywood's hottest new actress. All he had to do was find her the necklace from a forgotten film and not get killed in the process. From the insane house parties of Malibu and the reclusive mansions of Beverly Hills to the scorching California desert, Mike finds himself in a scandal involving one of the world's most eccentric billionaires, the Nevada Mafia, and a sadistic Estonian porn kingpin. To find the necklace, he'll have to blow the lid off a secret buried in the California desert that stretches back to ancient Egypt, with an irresistible client who won't take no for an answer. If the job doesn't get him killed, she just might. Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main has been described as a fast-paced love child of The Big Lebowski and Indiana Jones. Find out why readers have made this book one of the best reviewed in all of Amazon. It's Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main, available for only $2.99 on the Amazon Kindle store. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, ghouls and goblins, vampires and werewolves, welcome to the Weird Things broadcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Yay, folks, I'm back, and I'm definitely not a werewolf.
Pretty sure. And live from, we have no idea where, and he may be a werewolf because he's out at night for no reason we can understand, patrolling the roads, is Mr. Brian Brushwood.
I'm trying to understand Spiro a little bit better by going on patrol on my own. I got little Fudge with me, and I'm in this space capsule driving through the mountains of eastern Tennessee.
So just so everybody knows, very good chance he may drop in and out. And we will continue the conversation going up. We will make up points for him when we lose contact with him.
That's good. That's good.
Man, this is a hardy podcast. Like, I feel like we're like, I feel like this podcast could survive the Oregon Trail. Like, that's how good this podcast is at staying alive lately. For what was the most fragile podcast I think any of us had ever done before prior to this, it really, like, we took this doing this every week thing seriously. This is awesome.
No, I think, yeah, once we committed, I think it became, and, you know, and we got over the idea of, okay, if I can't be there, you guys are going to have somebody else. And then we realized we're all replaced. We haven't replaced Justin yet, have we, O'Brien?
Yeah.
Weird things can never die. Yeah, we
were. Oh, yeah, Paul did. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He replaced me last week. But, no, I mean, no. No, you've never replaced me, and you never shall.
So this is going to be a super spoilery podcast. We warned you last week. We're going to talk Prometheus.
Yeah.
Are we going to do that up top, or are we going to save that?
I think we do it up top.
Let's get into it.
Get into it. We saved up a lot of stuff to talk about, so I'll do a little quick news item. But I think just to warn people, if you haven't seen Prometheus yet and you want to, then once we say Prometheus talk starts now, then you've been warned.
But that time didn't count. That was just practicing saying those words.
Yes, exactly.
You could still listen to the podcast right now, but probably not for much longer.
No. I'll do a really quick, cool news item. You guys follow a little Voyager spacecraft?
Is that like the Muppet Babies version of the Voyager?
Yeah, right out there on the edge of the universe.
Yeah, so Voyager is, by some definitions, left the solar system.
No, I'll tell you, listen, color me an idiot, but yeah, explain what the hell's going on here.
So there's a thing called space.
Yes.
And Voyager 1, okay, has reached 11 billion miles from Earth. Okay, it's right on the cusp of leaving the solar system. There are these areas here that you have where there's what's called the termination shock, which is a you have like the heliosphere, then you have the space beyond that, and then as we move through space, we have we have this sort of tail. And Voyager's heading towards the edge of I guess it's called the heliosheath. New okay. term for me. And it's reaching the edge of that, and that apparently once it passes that, it's in interstellar space.
Jeez.
Well, and if I remember the article that I half read with my non-comprehending science stupid brain, the reason they know that it's outside of the solar system is because it's now catching solar breezes from other stars. And it's yeah. not like it, because normally when you're in the solar system, the sun is pumping out so much solar energy that the solar wind all goes one direction. But now, like, you are adrift in the universe proper, and now you're catching solar winds from other stars.
That's crazy, kind of cool to think about that. You know, we've sent a probe now that's just gone. You know, we've talked about this before. Where our solar system ends and the rest of the galaxy begins is a hard sort of thing to say, because beyond our solar system, beyond, let's say, you know, Neptune, Uranus, Pluto, the outer planets, whichever, I think Pluto is the most outermost. Well, it's not a planet anymore.
Yeah.
Neptune now. You have the Kuiper Belt, which is a bunch of these other objects and they're planetoids. You have, like, I guess, Sedna and some other ones out there. And then going further on out, you have the Oort cloud, which is where you get cometary objects and stuff, which might, you know, swing in from. And that's Voyager's still nowhere near that, as far as I understand. And so you have this other extended part of our solar system that goes. What's that?
Where's the part that says, "Here there be monsters"?
That's Saturn.
Is that it?
Yeah.
All right. So what is the mission? Is the mission of Voyager like, let's just rock and roll until there ain't no rocking to be had?
Yeah, Voyager fulfilled what it was supposed to do for its primary mission protocol, and now what they're doing is just sort of monitoring it using telemetry to see where it is, and just through telemetry alone, how fast it's moving tells us a lot, because you expect it to go a certain speed, but then when we encounter, you know, with solar winds and then with some of the other influences on it, it can actually change that and give us different data.
The solar winds came blowing in. Oh, Brian dropped off with my Sinatra impression.
We'll get him back. Brian has passed through the outer perimeter of civilization into
Tennessee.
Exactly.
He's stranded in the Delta. Voyager, oh, please come home. Come home.
Voyager.
Voyager, and we're stranded in the Delta. You've seen those videos, right? With the guy with the lyrics to all the Star Trek songs.
I don't know. I think just your interpretation of it alone was enough for me.
No, that's his song. I'm covering him. There's the dude.
I know. It's hearing you do it. I don't know if it can be improved upon.
No. Oh, good. Sweet Lord. Whatever his name is. It was something that me and Brian played the crap out of on NSFW, but the guy who sings all the Star Trek themes is an absolute
genius. Oh, wow. Did you bust out the Voyager sound?
And he's stranded in the Delta. Oh, please come home. Voyager, come home.
So how does this make you feel?
Look, Voyager is, I think you can make a case that it is the single greatest success story in all of the space program, bigger even than going to the moon and returning back. I mean, because, like, for all the good that did us, you know, we went there, did a push up on it, ate an egg on it, and then came home. And then meanwhile, Voyager just keeps on shocking with how far and the rich data that it keeps sending back. It's amazing to read the story of what it was meant to do and what it actually achieved instead.
Very true. Justin?
I think it's great. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time wrapping my head around it being the greatest achievement ever, because I think that we live in a human-focused society, and to me, the greatest achievements will always be ones that directly extend our, you know, our lineage. The history and future of humanity is paramount. So I don't know. I mean, I would say to me, Moon is still, you know, that represents us getting off Earth. And that's to me bigger than understanding, even though it's important to understand what's going on outside our solar system. It's not as big as, you know, going to the moon, and certainly not as big as us setting foot on any other planet like Mars or something.
Problem if we set foot on Mars is, you know, a week later, Neil deGrasse Tyson's going to say it's not a planet.
I'll tell you what, like, I'm afraid. I feel like I've crossed into a level with Weird Things where now, like, I don't want to talk. I don't want to even talk about Neil deGrasse Tyson because, like, I feel like I'm going to get yelled at for it. There's people that really like Neil deGrasse Tyson. I like Neil deGrasse Tyson, but, like, I feel like I can't disagree with Neil deGrasse Tyson without being barked at. I get barked at whenever that happens.
I get that too. I had a whole thing with the people who want to increase the funding for NASA, and I'm all for NASA getting more money. I have no problem if NASA consumed a larger part, but the caveats are, of course, for me, I think we need better accountability, just given how much money we've spent on stuff that doesn't go anywhere and how much pork barrel projects they have out there. And that's not, it's sometimes the only way they can get funded, but I think we need a structural change because, you know, the amount of money that gets spent that just never gets used. I mean, it gets spent on stuff that doesn't go anywhere. And then projects like we've talked before, the space launch system and how it's probably a big step backwards technically. And it's more just to please the military industrial complex and the senators who, you know, make NASA funding possible.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I think we've talked a lot about this, but, you know, yeah. It's just that I whenever I hear Neil deGrasse Tyson, like a dog, I just kind of like, I cow down. I'm just like, all right, it's fine. I don't want to talk about it. Cause if I talk about it, I'll get in trouble.
Yeah. We all like the guy. We all respect the guy. It just, you know, we feel that, you know, when it comes to space and then space policy, that becomes a different issue.
I feel like, why can't we all just dig space? Come on, man. Let's just hold hands and talk about space is great.
Yeah, space is awesome. Right, Brian, do you like space? Brian likes space.
Brian loves. Oh, God. You don't know. Brian gets so excited about space, sometimes he can't even talk. He just gets all choked up on it.
Yeah, I understand that. I'll tell you this. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when you have something, a cause that we all believe in, you know, we all sort of want the same sort of goal, but how you get there, you know, is a matter of some sort of discussion. And that's where it gets kind of sketchy. And it's a matter of throwing more money at something is not always the answer to it. And, you know, we talked a little bit before the show about where Microsoft is, where Google is, and where Apple is. Apple had nowhere near the financial resources that Microsoft did 10 years ago. Apple was a fraction of what Microsoft's size was, yet Apple used its resources in a very smart, targeted way that this year Apple's expected to have the highest recorded profit of any public company ever, including when oil companies find, you know, billions of oil they didn't realize they had. So, you know, that's just proof that smart application of resources, you can do very amazing things. Throwing money at a problem often can sometimes take you further away from the problem. You need a certain amount to solve it, but just blindly throwing it at it can cause problems.
All right, let me ask you this, Andrew. With Voyager, do you think that this is the most impressive news we will see from Voyager, or do you think that we will see more impressive things from it going forward?
Well, I mean, if you look at the history of Voyager, you know, it's over like 30 years of what it's done and the amount of data and information it's given us. And it's kind of exciting, too, because you look at it where it wasn't, by contemporary standards, a very expensive mission. It was a mission that we had to be patient for and wait years and years to get this data from it. But it's not got a whole lot. The things that we can expect to know now really just have to deal with its speed and where we think the boundaries for certain things are. And I don't know what surprises are really going to be in store in that way, other than maybe confirming suspicions.
Yeah.
But I'm not an expert. Like, Brian.
What more do you want from Voyager? She's given you her everything.
I know.
She's given her life. She's slowly dying, and there's just her like, pretty good run so far, but you think we're going to get something good?
Well, no, yeah. I didn't say that. I was just like, I'm curious if you guys think there's going to be anything else. If it's like, that's the story of Voyager.
What do you want to do? Go find alien life, come back to Earth, threaten us, and like turn bald female sex monsters into zombies?
I saw Star Trek 1, the motion picture.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Voyager's got a very interesting history ahead of her.
Yes. Voyager.
Hey, speaking of movie.
Before we get to a movie, let me read a little sponsored spot here. It comes from Stacey Baldwin. She says, "Hello, boys. This is my birthday present to myself. I love weird things so much that I decided to celebrate my 26th birthday by sponsoring the show. As far as the ad reads go, feel free to say any plethora of awesome things. So we wish to Stacey Baldwin a happy 26th birthday. And we would like to remind you that if you would like to buy a $30 Weird Thing sponsored spot, please go ahead by going over to weirdthings.com/sponsor, and I'll read whatever you want right here on this podcast. So Andrew, Brian, wish Stacey happy birthday.
Oh, more than that, Stacey, you have been a big supporter of us, and we absolutely appreciate it. We love you. We appreciate it very much. You're a friend of the show. You're a friend of all of us. Happy birthday. We're going to all blow you kisses right now.
Mwah.
Brian blew a kiss so hard. He knocked himself off of Google Hangout. It's amazing. That's how much he loves you. Or maybe he's like jumping out of a cake right now, pulled over on the side of the road, and is doing a special dance, which he's going to video on his iPhone and send to you.
Absolutely.
That's the kind of thing we do for people who support our show. And their name's Stacey Baldwin, and it's her 26th birthday. So that's a pretty awesome. Thank you so much. That makes us feel really nice. Very, very good, Stacey, that you did that. We hope you have an awesome birthday.
All right. Well, yeah, we wait for Brian to get back here, and now he is back here on Google Hangouts. Let's set the table, if you will, for what is going to be the Prometheus discussion.
Let's do one more segment, then we will do the Prometheus. How about that?
Oh, okay. So we are saving it for the end.
No, because we're building up. It's another space topic.
Okay.
Okay. So.
All right, let's go.
Io9 had an article, and it was a story about something relating to topics Io9 covers. And what this was, and I've heard this before, Jeff Marcy told Io9 that he'd like SETI, he's the chair for SETI at the University of California, Berkeley, to start searching the depths of space for Dyson spheres. As we talked about before, a Dyson sphere is a structure that would totally encompass a star so you could capture all of its radiative energy.
Yeah.
Okay. And concept was by Freeman Dyson, who's a physicist, just incredible free-range sort of thinker, just always out there with a lot of different ideas. He theorized that that would be like the highest level of engineering for a civilization, or a very high level for a civilization, would be at the point where they decide to capture all of the solar energy by completely encasing their star. And it's been used in some science fiction books, Pandora's Star, yeah, which is a one we've all read and enjoyed. And so many people think that, and it's been in Star Trek. So the idea is you have this sphere that's so large and encompasses your entire star, and then you can build on top of, you can build on the inside of it, like living inside of the Earth. And so it's dense enough that you would be able to be stuck to it. You know, your feet would stick to the ground and you'd have gravity, and you would have, like, the amount of surface area you would have to live on would be colossal.
So, so how would you find one of these? You would look for what appears to be a wall behind which there may be a star? I mean, if it captured all the energy.
if you did this to our sun and you built this sphere, theoretically, the amount of radiation it would get off would have a certain heat signature, and so you would scan the sky for that signature.
Man, now this is a case where, because we can conceive of a civilization advanced enough to do this, that we ought to start just looking for it. That seems like a bit of a jump. This is like, I can't remember which of the arguments for God it was. I want to say, that, not the ontological or the teleological, but the one that basically said, if man can conceive of a perfect being, aka God, and it's more perfect to exist than not exist, therefore God must exist. That's what this seems like to me. Like, because we can conceive of a alien civilization so advanced that they could do this, that if they're out there, they must have done this. So we should start looking for their Dyson spheres.
Justin?
I don't know what the hell Brian just said. That was crazy talk.
I'm gonna agree with Brian, and from a different point of view. I think Dyson spheres are a neat idea. They're a charming idea. But to me, it makes about as much sense as saying we should use our telescopes to look for railroads, you know, for rail, because obviously a really highly advanced civilization would have rail running from planet to planet and star to star or whatever. I mean, it's just this, you know, that would be how somebody in the 19th century might look at this. And for
that would
us
be pretty bad. Actually,
let's look for those steam engines in space. You know, they'll have oxygen feeding the coal, but it's a 20th century, not even 21st, it's a 20th century idea of what an advanced civilization would do, and it assumes a lot of things. One is that everybody on the damn planet can agree to, you know, let's take apart our entire solar system and let's build this thing. You know, when you can't even get a permit for a Krispy Kreme in some city. I don't see, you know, the zoning.
Well, to what advantage?
What's that?
To what advantage? Like, let's say we're in the future. We're all wearing our white robes. And all of a sudden, you know, Andrew comes in with a big A on his chest. It says, it's very important that we build a Dyson sphere because, it's like, what, because why?
Yeah, well, here the assumption is you would have max amount of energy for computation, all these other things. But here's another thing, too, is the failure in a lot of science fiction, and Star Trek would do this a lot, and most science, not most, but a lot of science fiction, is the idea of monoculture. They go to a planet, and the entire planet is one culture. You know, here we imagine an advanced civilization, and it's all one culture, where they all have one government and one set of ideals and one religion, and everybody thinks this is a cool idea. If anything,
and they all take monorails.
Usually, when they're writing these monocultures, they're usually thinly veiled ripoffs of a splinter culture on Earth.
Yeah, you know, and it's this. You know, as we progress technically, we certainly have certain advanced societies. We start to resemble each other in certain ways. You go to downtown London, downtown New York City, or Shanghai, a lot of things are similar. They're very different governments there, but we tend to have this path towards, let's say, freedom and markets, etc. But, you know, we have 6 billion individuals on our planet, and, you know, we can agree where it cooperates, but, you know, really bold ideas like, let's take apart our solar system. I'm wondering, I don't know if we'll ever terraform Mars. I don't know if we'll ever get, you know, we go to Mars, we'll have a consensus on being able to do that. I think you're going to have some people like, hey, let's leave Mars the way it is. Let's live on Mars.
Have you read Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars trilogy?
No, I haven't.
It's about exactly that, and it's great because you have the geologists who, you know, feel like there's this wealth of ancient data from this other world. And they want to be able to study it without, you know, you go terraforming, you're going to ruin it. You're going to ruin the rock structures. You're going to have bacteria chewing through the rock. And it's going to, so essentially you have the greens become this, you know, progressive manifest destiny. Mars is ours to mold and shape as we like. And the reds, who, you know, politically are essentially Greenpeace here on Earth. You know, they're all like, don't touch nothing. Keep Mars the way it should be. And I guarantee you, a big part of that trilogy is about the political fights between the two and the terrorism that ends up happening for militants who don't want to see Mars changed.
So there you go. proof. And so, you know, for a Dyson sphere, as exciting as an idea as I think it is, and the problem too is like the way they kind of conceive them in science fiction isn't really the practical way you would make them. And also, you know, it involves, you know, unobtainium. You know, you've, in order to stick to the ground, you've got to have this extremely dense material to be able to do that. And, you know, I heard somebody came out with a proposal like, oh, you know, we could start building a Dyson sphere now. And it's like, well, one, why? You know, to what advantage? There are far, far, if you're looking for land to live on, you could take apart, you know, I do these fun, some fun sort of mathematics. You know, we could take apart one of the major asteroids like Ceres or whatever. And if we wanted to start building cylindrical space habitats or whatever, you know, there's enough material there. You take away 10% of it and you can start creating the land area of, you know, two Europes. You know, take it apart entirely and you can probably build, you know, another Earth.
Wow. But all right, hold on. Can we roll it back? So what was the thing that started this? Like somebody gave someone money to look for Dyson spheres?
Well, no, a guy with SETI says that we should start looking for them. He thinks we should change our priorities to looking for Dyson spheres because some people think that that's going to be the way you find an advanced civilization.
Okay. All right. So instead of listening for radio transmissions of something, we should be looking for the structures that they are building. And our best guess for a very advanced civilization is a Dyson sphere. That's basically what. So, yeah, that sounds really silly. That sounds like a really silly idea. Right.
And I think that, you know, we don't know what physics.
So if you wanted to make a beacon that just shouted to the world, I guess.
All right. Well, I think what Brian was trying to say.
Sorry, I had lag, so you're probably hearing me say something from a while ago.
Brian, you there?
I am, but I'm afraid to talk because there's apparently lag, and then I start to cut you off. Dang it!
Okay. I think, Brian, Tess.
It's the aliens interfering.
It is the aliens interfering. I think what Brian was trying to say is that, like, if you're trying to just make if you're trying to make contact, right, or you're trying to find civilizations, you want to put it on the most basic understood level possible. That if you just saw a blinking light from far away, right, like, you might not know if it was in an otherwise barren wasteland, you might not know exactly what that meant or, you know, whatever, you're just looking for whatever good, you know, it looks, it's different on the horizon. There's enough of something to intrigue you to explore further. So
if they don't, and that's, Brian brings up a very good point in that if you're trying to call attention to yourself, you can do a very good job of it. If you're building a Dyson sphere and you don't want anybody to see you, then I would think this advanced civilization would probably have figured out how to fool our telescopes and we ain't going to see it.
I guess, I mean, it's just sort of like planning and looking for the
unknown. Yeah, well, and I guess also, so, I was going to say that tactically, is there any advantage to any alien civilization to let humanity know they're, I mean, it's like, it seems like as soon as humanity is able to conceal our location, we should, because nothing good will come of other aliens knowing we're here and us not knowing that they're out there.
Yeah, but we won't be able to because we'll never be able to agree to that.
Yeah, I mean, that goes to the terraforming thing.
And the monoculture. Yeah. We won't agree to, and I think that I think that if it's nothing but a net benefit to be able to talk to, because it's not like it's practical to go, you know, to other solar systems to steal resources when the space is filled with so many abundant resources. And the fact that we can't find any evidence of civilizations out there kind of tells us it's not like there's a population problem in the galaxy. You know, if you have to deal with, you know, religious nuts or something, it might be something different, but I kind of think that I'm not as worried. And that's based upon, you know, economics and Ricardo's principles and stuff like that, that kind of show that as you become more advanced, you tend to be, you have a bigger respect for ideas and markets of ideas. And that means markets, and you understand.
Well, and no. I guess you would have to enter to even be able to physically travel from one star to another. You have to reach a level of a constraint-free economy. You have to be able to wield so much, you know, technology and ability that I agree. It's like, even if we're just backwards, I mean, I don't know that there's a lot of money in being a sadistic band of rovers who go into hypersleep for hundreds or thousands of years in order to show up just to ruin our day.
Yeah, it's, you know, when there's more water.
What an awesome pirate story, though.
Yeah, when there's more water on, you know, Europa than there is on Earth, and, you know, all the really precious minerals and stuff that you want to get are already free-floating around the solar system and, like, around the galaxy, and you don't have to deal with the gravity well of Earth to get them.
Yeah.
You know, what's the one thing to go to Earth? And other than to have sex with our women, you know, it's for culture. And, you know, then that's the kind of thing you just don't come here and, like, they're not going to, like, sneak into Blockbuster in the middle of the night and copy all our DVDs and sneak off and then blow up the planet. I think.
Possibly.
Now that I've said that out loud, though.
Why are you going to deal with that when Will Smith can just hijack one of your ships and blow you up? You know, like, sure. There's just no need to do it. Go, you just show up, man. You're always welcome. We'll leave the light on for you.
Get a Netflix subscription with Watch Instantly.
Yes. And they'll just hang out outside, just outside of orbit. Be like, can you believe they took off Veronica Mars? This is bull.
Wasn't that a Futurama episode where, like, some show, Earth show they watched got canceled or something, and they showed up to have a
to protest it? That does sound familiar. I'm sure somebody's yelling at their phone right now.
Yeah. You idiots.
Don't you know? So,
there was also that South Park, Circle of Humanity, was just reality television for the aliens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So,
all right.
Speaking of space and aliens and stuff.
One more sponsored spot here. Justin Frazier would like to, he says further push, but he has not mentioned it yet. So this will represent the first push for Brian's book, Scam School Book 2. Remind everyone to buy it on release day, which is tomorrow, June 19th. And put 50 Shades of Grey back in its place. Also, please buy all of Andrew Main's books. Thank you, Justin Frazier, for buying an advertisement on our podcast to plug the products from Two of Us.
Can we go ahead and call it best fan ever? Pays just to get. He's like, guys, I'm really worried about on your show whether or not you're going to plug your stuff. So I'm going to take a bullet on this one. I'm going to give you money. Tell you need to
he gave us
stuff.
$30 American to put an ad, another ad for things that are sold by the host onto this show. It's so meta, it's amazing.
I love this. This makes me extraordinarily happy.
So there we go. Thank you, Justin Frazier. Now,
thank you.
Justin, let's talk about what we've all been brought here for. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yes. Spoiler alert, folks.
Yeah.
Spoilers begin now.
This movie sucked.
Brian, was that your take on it?
I've gone through this once on Frame Rate, but I'm going to do my best to give a different take to you guys.
I'm going to give you a whole other thing to think about, too. Go ahead.
Okay. I think most of my frustrations, the reason I'm so passionate about my frustration with this movie is because it really struck the uncanny valley. There was so much about this movie that was absolutely exquisite. The cinematography was amazing. Special effects were incredible. Some of the performances, Michael Fassbender as David was one of the best takes on an android I think I've ever seen. But I am convinced that I did not see the entire movie. There's entire chunks that made no sense and characters made idiotic decisions. I did not feel a kinship or a bonding with any of them. None of them grew. Guy Pearce, there was no justifiable reason for him to be there in crappy makeup. There's all of these things just stood out and really bummed me out about the movie. Now, having said that, I think people should see it, but expect to. There was a couple of moments of completely unnecessary fan service that tied, you know, that. Essentially said, by the way, this answers this minor question in a movie that was made 30
years
ago.
Well, say it, Brian. This is spoilers. So say it.
Well, that whole scene at the end where they have a xenomorph pop out of the guy. It's like, who cares? That was utterly unnecessary, and it only served to say, like, see, this is what led up to that opening scene of Alien. And it's like, it's irrelevant. Let this be its own movie. If you're gonna go out of your way to keep telling everyone that it's not a prequel, then don't waste my time with the minute of something loudly and flatly stating that this is leading directly into the movie.
Well, because it was. And if this is going to be a trilogy, then I took that last scene to be, hey, next movie you get xenomorphs.
I didn't take that at all. Let me throw something out here, okay?
Go.
So let's go over just a quick summary. So we have a young woman, scientist, obsessed with aliens, loses her father at a young age, which probably gives her some father issues, pleads with this billionaire for funding. He's inaccessible, but eventually watches her secretly, remotely, and agrees to fund her. She finds this invitation that's sort of this kind of ambiguous invitation, but it's basically like to connect or contact the aliens. We meet the aliens, but it's at a halfway point. It's not really where they are. The aliens are kind of these paternalistic aliens that are kind of like not really impressed with us. It's got a very ambiguous resolution. We don't get proof back in the world about whether or not this happens because the characters go on a sort of another certain journey. The heroine we're left with where she has to keep searching to sort of resolve this, what's going on.
Okay.
Do you agree?
Yeah, those are all, oh, wait a minute. I see what you're doing.
I just described contact. Let's go for the bonus things, okay? Aided by a blonde, we'll say hunkish guy, known for taking off his clothes. Okay, contact was Matthew McConaughey. In this, it was Michael Fassbender. We got there was all this quasi-mystical questions, the purpose of the search. And so that was the purpose of the blonde-haired guy, was to sort of like, what does this mean about me and my own, you know, identity and all this? You know, then we'll add in, you know, we have, turns out long, long time ago, these alien dudes came here and dropped off this black oil. I mean, black goo. I mean, DNA. That's from the X-Files. But anyhow, about the contact thing, I'm like, Carl Sagan should have got story credit on this one. It was contact with xenomorphs.
Okay, but the difference was I understood the characters in Contact, and I could name them after the movie was
over.
And it.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think Andrew's point isn't that it was good like Contact. I think it was just that it's gotten a complete free pass on being a bit of a bite on Contact.
I mean, I think that I have no I writing stuff. You know, I'm influenced by a lot of things, and everything I've done. I'd go, well, was this and this influenced me? That was the thing. As I sat down, I'm like, man, there are 9 story points in Contact. The layout in down to the details, you know, the heroine, the girl in science, father dies while she's young, father issues, you know, in Contact to get funding. She goes to ask and it goes Hammond and she's talking to the board and doesn't realize he's secretly watching her. And the online footage for this, and I think it was in the part of this, you know, you see in the online footage you could see for this where she's pleading with him to watch and you realize that she's being secretly watched by Wayland on a satellite feed. And then, I mean, all of these points, which I go were like kind of major beats to it that I go, man, I mean, it just lines up. It's Contact with xenomorphs. Brian is speechless. His mouth can move, but words can't come out.
Well put, sir.
All right. But I have a thing that I do want to talk about.
Let me just say, though, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Prometheus. I had frustrations like everybody else. And like Brian says, I think you could see it. I think you should see this. There's a lot of things to think about. And I think Lindelof and Ridley Scott put a lot of effort in this and a lot of craft into this. I was just kind of, and my notes is more about, I'm surprised that other reviewers have not pointed out how much of that was, how much of those story points we saw. And I kind of, pardon me, I like to say, if it were lesser filmmakers or writers, we may have heard that.
Well, but it's not like people have not beat up on Lindelof. And this is so Brian, after Brian sees it midnight on Thursday, I get a call from a I would describe a very, very frustrated to the upper levels of frustration with, as frustrated as Brian gets about popular art. Wound up Brian Brushwood, who's like, I'm going to go live on the internet and I'm going to talk about this movie and I'm pissed off about it. And I'm, you know, like, and lists a lot of what he said at the beginning of this segment. And it's goddamn Damon Lindelof. And it got me thinking, because Damon Lindelof has, Brian's not alone. He's gotten a big fat load of crap for this movie. He's gotten a lot stuck to him. But in
and by the way, I should, to be fair to Damon Lindelof, I follow him on Twitter. I liked the way he wrapped stuff up with Lost. I thought he did a fine job. And it was with hesitation that I have to place the blame at someone's feet. And it's the writer's fault when the characters aren't interesting. Or,
well, wait. Here's the thing, though. We don't know what was in the script. We don't know what was shot and what ended up on the floor. We don't know a lot of these things. And so, we don't know if the studio went in and did. And especially when you're working with a guy like Ridley Scott, who's going to get out of his way. And there's so many factors that come in here. I'm hesitant, you know, to say how much I lay it at somebody's feet.
I agree with Andrew. I mean, my thought after watching the movie is not that this is, you know, Damon Lindelof's fault. I think that the movie does have a lot of problems. I think that it is a very, you know, both of you guys have touched on it. I think it's a detached movie. I did not personally feel a lot for the characters, specifically our main character, the girl with the xenomorph tattoo. I really didn't think that. I felt much of for her journey. You know, the only thing that we see, of her emotionally beyond holding her boyfriend's hand and taking the worst possible opportunity to bang him is, you know, with another young actress in a flashback with her dad. So I didn't really feel a whole lot for, ironically, the person with the most humanity in the movie is David, who is the only person I think who has any kind of journey at all. But at the same time, I don't know if I can say that this is a Lindelof problem and not a Scott problem. And I'm not saying that it is. I'm just saying it's, I think that the Lindelof hate is residual Lost hate. I do think that it's people who are just, they were upset and frustrated with Lost, and they were upset and frustrated with this movie, and they've combined the two, because there are a lot of moments in this movie and themes in this movie that are reminiscent of Lost. And there's a lot of problems in this movie where, like you said, Brian, that you don't feel like you finished watching a film. I agree with you in the sense that there's a lot of stuff that's just kind of left hanging there that I thought was just completely dangling until Andrew had mentioned to me that they want to do this as a trilogy, and they had planned elements of this to be a trilogy. And so I guess they want to explain these things in later movies, which I think is a problem, because it takes away from your enjoyment of Prometheus.
Yeah, it's one of those, I wish they hadn't saved anything. If you got a bigger story, I understand wanting to hold stuff back so that you could set up interesting questions, but I think that's the difference, where it's like the first Star Wars just naturally created so many awesome questions in your mind just by mentioning the Clone Wars. Like, oh, what are the Clone Wars? I want to know what those are. That thing just dripped with questions, and I wanted to know more about the world. I felt like I was being told what questions I should have, and the answers were deliberately withheld on this one, instead of it happening organically because I was falling in love with the characters of the story or the universe.
And I'll say, to your point, using Star Wars as our example, is Star Wars starts off with the objectives. Princess Leia wants, spoiler alert, Princess Leia wants to stop the completion of the Death Star. Luke Skywalker wants to go off into space, be a pilot, be a part of something important. Obi-Wan Kenobi, we realize, wants to pass on and look out for and see that Luke follows his destiny. Han Solo is a guy, you know, a man without a country, who really deep down wants to find a cause that he can care for. And at the end of that movie, all four of those things are met. We get that. Death Star blows up. Han Solo is now part of the rebellion. Luke has got a purpose. Leia has made this, you know, helped advance the cause of freedom. what? We get another movie in this universe, you know? And that's and that's a problem with Prometheus. Again, I think, again, I respect, we all love Lindelof and Ridley Scott. I think those guys are great. They've done some great entertainment, and this is coming from a point of, you know, they've done far better things than I will ever be able to hope to achieve in my life. But coming from somebody just saying, if I'm going to be analytical about it and point out the contact connections, you know, Carl Sagan's talked about this in his book. But I think that the problem I had here was this starts off with this question is why did the aliens go do this? Why did they? And we assume that it's Earth at the beginning, but it doesn't matter, according to Ridley Scott. Why did they do this? At the end of the movie, we still don't know why. In fact, we get another mystery, you know, midway through where there's some sort of conflict between them, you know, where either one of them's trying to come back and destroy us, the other ones are trying to stop him or whatever. You know, it's not quite resolved. We know there's some big crisis that happened 2,000 years ago, which may not be coincidentally when Space Jesus came down to Earth, according to some descriptions,
yes.
And then we killed him. So it's these things where it's fine to leave a movie with more questions. But when you start off with a movie with a question and you don't answer the damn question by the end of the movie.
Or even reference it again. Like, like it wasn't until afterward that I heard people suggest that that was taking place on Earth. If it was Earth, they certainly picked a very alien-looking way to represent Earth. So it's like, as far as I could tell, it's some dude who makes a noble sacrifice for some reason that I don't understand. And then it's just never referenced again. Nothing at all.
No, I read that. I didn't know there was a question that wasn't Earth, that opening scene. I thought that was him dying on Earth and spreading his seed, if you will.
Yeah, see, I totally read it as because the color palette matched the bizarre color palette of the alien world that they went to as well. And like I said, the opening shot sweeping over, it looks like an alien landscape to me. I mean, nothing about that looked like Earth to me.
Well, that was supposed to be like primordial Earth.
Okay, you can communicate primordial Earth without looking. I mean, maybe I'm just the only one, but it didn't read as Earth to me or primordial Earth, and it led me astray.
Yeah.
All right. So, all being said, would you go see a sequel, Brian?
Yes, I would. Because here's the question, though. Can you think of another franchise where the first movie was really meh or had problems as big as Prometheus has, and the second movie just comes and knocks it out of the park? Can you think of anything like that?
Think our silence tells the tale.
Now, having said that, I'll still go and see it because I want this universe to be more compelling than it ended up being, and I want the story to be better than it ended up being. So I would definitely go back again. It's not like I hated it and I was angry that I spent the money and I was bitter that I gave a dollar vote to such a turd, because that wasn't the case at all. It's that uncanny valley of excellence that really drove me nuts about the giant flaws that are in this movie.
All right. One last question for you, Brian. This obviously garnered.
Can I just say I'm in on the sequel too?
Okay.
And I do want to add to that, have things gotten better or whatever? I would say that I found the Star Wars prequels disappointing. But by the time I got to episode 4, it was really good.
Yes.
In all seriousness, the Clone Wars, the cartoon series, very good. I enjoy the Clone Wars, and it tells me that with Lucas and that team there, they kind of, once they wrapped their head around the story they wanted to do, things got better. I would say that there have been instances where you've had the second one has been technically better than, like, you know, Toy Story 2 was even better than Toy Story 1, but Toy Story 1 was such a knock it out of the park one. Superman 2 to Superman 1, Spider-Man 2. I thought was much better than Spider-Man 1.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, none of those, like, Spider-Man 1 wasn't deeply flawed, and Superman
It was to me.
That's closer. I would say Spider-Man 1 is a very deeply flawed. I mean, it's at times kind of a boring movie.
Oh, my God. I love Spider-Man. That's really interesting.
I mean, when's the last time you watched Spider-Man 1? Especially compared to Spider-Man 2.
Right, you know, now, while he's driving. Years.
I've got another iPhone here. I'm watching it.
Well, because I would say, like, there's a lot of those movies, and I would say X-Men and Spider-Man and Blade, where, like, there it was in that halo of, like, oh, my God, the comic book movies that aren't Superman, you know, can be really, 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 really awesome. Like, in the beginning of that boom, you know?
Right.
That I think...
Well, and it was... I think I was just giddy the entire time because Spider-Man is such a different kind of character from, you know, in that he's snarky and the mere way he fights was always... You couldn't... Before computer animation got to where it was, it wasn't possible to show the style of fighting that Spider-Man did. It wasn't possible to have him be the kind of character that he was. And I was just giddy from beginning to end to see that. And plus also, you know, being a fan of Sam Raimi and seeing him knock it out of the park with a big, I think I was just, you know, maybe it was skewed because I wanted it to succeed so bad.
I did too. And I loved it coming out of the theater. Rewatching it, it's got a lot of problems. I mean, at least for me.
Yeah. And I just like throw in there, like you look at Terminator 2. You know, Terminator was great. Terminator 2 was great. Empire Strikes Back. And they figured out what the DNA was. Comeback did it even bigger and better. Godfather 2 and that. And again, those were strong movies to begin with. You know, stronger than Prometheus is. But the talent is there. We know the capability is there. So I will absolutely, like, again, like Brian and I are trying to make the same thing is we're hypercritical because we care. And there's so much potential there. But we're both back in for the sequel.
Sure.
Sure.
One final question for me on this. Does this movie had a lot of anticipation for it? It was circled, you know, in what is a very geek friendly summer for movies. It was put for a lot of people that everybody who listens to this podcast or is on this podcast, you know, would consider friends. It was put amongst Batman, Avengers, these AAA kind of titles in terms of anticipation. Knowing now what the movie is, does it affect for you how you think of Ridley Scott and Damon Lindelof? Yes or no to both?
I mean, I'm not going to unknow what I know about the movie, and I'm not going to not count it against their record. Will I still go see a movie and be excited because it's a Ridley Scott movie? Yes, of course. Will I still go see a movie knowing that it's written by Damon Lindelof? Yes, of course. I mean, I think I'm bummed. You know, it's like I'm still a fan of the sports team, and I still hope they knock it out of the park. And it's just a bummer to watch guys who you like, this is me trying to do a sports analogy, step up to the plate and whiff three in a row, you know? And it's like, well, that really is a bummer. I hope that doesn't happen next time.
So you're saying it's a bummer that they step up to the plate and just drop the winning field goal.
Yes, exactly. And especially in the last quatrain. I mean, that's when they really need to cross the line.
Andrew, Ridley Scott, yes or no? Do you think of him differently? And Damon Lindelof, do you think of him differently post-Prometheus?
Well, I'm going to think of him differently. And I don't know. Ridley Scott... I'm a big fan. I think I have every one of his movies on DVD, even like The Duelist. And, you know, I absolutely think he's a brilliant director. I think sometimes, you know, he gets into these very big, massive kind of projects, and then the threads of the story sometimes get tangled. And this is a great example of that, in that the thing about, I'll say to all the other movies we've seen this summer, you know, the Avengers. Avengers, we've got to defeat Loki. We've got to come together. We've got to defeat Loki. That's what happens.
Yes.
You know, you look, you know, we assume with, you know, in Brave, you know, she's going to have to defeat whatever sort of threat she's up against. You know, Dark Knight. Nolan, we talked about before, is Nolan's a guy, when he made Batman Begins, he put it all out there into that movie. Said, I'm just going to tell the best origin story I can. The only thing I'll even hint that there's a future is I'll have a little thing, you know, this little crazy card, you know, from the Joker, just to show this has changed things. You know, and the Dark Knight comes out, everything's in there like that. He's not trying to write in, how am I going to have the Joker again or anything like that. He just wants to tell the best story he can. And so When it comes to this movie, I think the problem was, like I said before, they set up that it's like, it's about this question. And then you find out we don't get the answer to that.
Yeah.
And that's right. That's kind of well, from a storytelling point of view.
Even worse, you have an entire setup that represents the reason for the journey to be one thing. And instead what you get is just, you know, crazy rabid dogs there. And I don't know. It's not just that they disappointing answer. It's that they just pretended like you were an idiot for expecting an answer. And that was frustrating.
In summation, run sideways, Charlize. Just run sideways and not straight parallel with the ship. What's the problem, man? Like, you see the shadow, run to the place where there's light.
That's awesome.
Well, you know, let he who has never had a colossal alien mega spaceship on top of him cast the first space rock, okay?
Exactly. So there we go. Is that that's the big Prometheus download? Any final thoughts, Brian, Andrew?
No, man. I'm ready to talk picks. I'm excited about what I'm bringing.
I'm just gonna say as a quick side note, I am excited about the idea of Ridley Scott going back into the Blade Runner universe.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, that's my final thought. If Prometheus was nothing but Michael Fassbender shaking his junk into the camera for 2 hours and saying "aliens, aliens," I would still be super excited for the Blade Runner prequel. I don't care what this movie was. Ridley Scott doing more Blade Runner is something where I don't care what he's doing now. That's going to be amazing.
All right. Let's do picks, boys and girls. No more sponsor reads?
No.
Brian, you want to go first?
Yeah, okay. So I mentioned the Mars Trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson. And if you haven't read it, I'm sure it's on audiobook or you should... They're big volumes. I really enjoyed it because the science in it is so strong and so hard. A lot of it is speculative, but it forces you to live and really wrap your mind around the practical things that it would take to live on Mars. And there are structures that there are little things that stick in your mind, like you know that the Martian day is 24 hours and I think 20 minutes. And so the way they handle that in time, because obviously we have a 24-hour clock here on Earth, is they have you go all the way till midnight, and then they have this magic little time called the time slip where the clock stops and a separate clock counts up 21 minutes and then it starts again at 12:01. So it's sort of, you got this extra time every day, and there are rituals people develop. There are religions that people start, you know, this this worship of Ka, which is the, you know, Martian word for Martian, according to some of the folks who live there. The political maneuvering, it's all eminently believable, and a couple of structural things they do to make characters live long enough to see terraforming happen on there. I think it's a very realistic portrayal of what the 300-year journey to terraform Mars could look like. And it's stuck with me for over a decade now. And he also has another book of short stories called The Martians, telling individual scientists tale. Very, very pro-science, and it gives a very... you have to learn some heavy-duty crap about geology and astrophysics to follow along. But that's actually not my pick. I do recommend you listen to it. My pick is... I went back and checked out Disney's Tron Uprising on Disney XD, and it is shockingly good. Bonnie watched an episode with me, and she was confused. She said, wait, is this meant for kids? One of the things that you get, it takes place...
out Michael there. Fassbender, it, full frontal nudity.
Aliens, aliens!
Exactly. Much as the Animatrix was in every way what I hoped to get from the Matrix sequels, Tron Uprising looks like it's going to deliver everything that I really wanted from the Tron Legacy movie, because there were big things that were about two-thirds of Tron Legacy was really, really good, and fully the middle one-third is nothing but people sitting around drinking space wine and talking slowly at each other. But Tron Uprising does not have that problem. It's visually stunning. It's gorgeous.
Because they can't show space wine on Disney XD.
Exactly, right? but they can show killing. I mean, that's the amazing thing, because these aren't people, they're programs. You see characters that you love just freaking get killed right in front of you. And it's amazing. I loved it, and it was way, way good.
Have you seen it, Andrew?
No, I've not. Cartoons are for kids.
Oh, jerk.
That's Clone Wars true. Doesn't count.
Oh, let me say another thing that I thought was really interesting. I watched just the most recent episode, and I could tell that I think I did it just right, because there were characters that were established by this point with motivations that I picked up on very fast in situations that that were finally coming to a head. And that was really good. Let me see episode one. Went back and watched episode one, and I was shocked, because episode one began with previously on Tron Uprising. It was the pilot episode, and it began with previously on this show that didn't even happen. And I thought that was awesome, because what they had done is they had released a bunch of 3-minute webisodes that take care of all that usual setting up the world type thing that you get out of most pilots. So as a result, it hits the ground running, and I dug it a lot.
That's a cool idea.
So I'll do you want to do yours, or you want me to do mine?
Well, let me do mine, because mine sucks, because I haven't read anything or watched anything interesting. So let me just talk about a book that I really, really like. It's a comic book. It's called Preacher. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's really awesome. Brian, have you read Preacher?
No, I need to. I'm being told in no uncertain terms. I know I need to read Preacher. I need to read Lock and Key, and I need to read, what is it, Incorruptible? Whatever that one is.
Well, I'll tell you what. Preacher. I'm shocked you haven't read Preacher, because Preacher is like kind of one of those things that's sort of made for you, like down to like it's very Texas-centric and
right on.
It's it's pretty cool. Basically, it follows the story of a man who is a faithless preacher. He's kind of fallen out with the Lord, and then all of a sudden, through some rumblings in heaven, a angel comes down and delivers unto him, in bloody fashion, the voice of God. So he has imbued in him a ability to tell whatever he says. People will do, and he has to reconcile with that power and goes on an epic journey along with his girlfriend, his long lost girlfriend, and his vampire best friend, for whom he makes within the first issue. So I would say go ahead and check it out. It's very, very well received, and it can probably be talked about way better than I have right here, but go ahead and buy it. Preacher.
All right. I'm going to do my pick. And somebody mentioned this on Twitter, and it reminded me of something I kept meaning to go and listen to, because when it first came out, I totally missed out on it. And it was one of those things where I remember at one point wanting to, and then it was so expensive to get it. You know, as a kid, I couldn't buy it. And then later on, I kind of was changed mediums and formats. And then finally, through the magic of Audible, I was able to find this again. And I was not one of the lucky ones that actually got us here at the first time around, which always meant that I had sort of a not the same wonderful childhood that other people had. And that was the Star Wars radio drama that aired on National Public Radio.
So good. I have the fondest memories. We're talking about how Star Wars just gives you so many questions. I remember listening to and re-listening to the public radio drama just for like those 2 or 3 scenes that weren't in the movie. And I'm just like, this is amazing. This is like, you get scenes like Luke Skywalker listening to an Imperial recruitment tape, excited about the idea of joining the Empire just so he can fly. It's
the Academy.
Yes, the Academy.
Absolutely. So, and it was a 13-part radio serial. It was the total length was 5 hours and 51 minutes. So the original Star Wars is 2 hours. So there's 3 more hours of Star Wars inside of there. And what's kind of fascinating is the cast. They actually got Mark Hamill to come back and do the voice of Luke Skywalker. They had Anthony Daniels doing C-3PO. What was interesting was who else they got. They had Perry King did the voice of Han Solo. If you ever remember the show Riptide, he was there. So popular radio actor. And he actually read for Han Solo originally. And instead the part, and so did Kurt Russell, but the part went to Harrison Ford, who went on to do nothing else of any import. you had also in there, you have Adam Arkin playing the Fixer, who's one of Luke Skywalker's friends. You go, who's Adam Arkin? If you watch Sons of Anarchy, he's the racist cigar shop owner who moves into town. Wow. Son of Alan Arkin. You have Darth Vader was voiced by Brock Peters. You go, Brock Peters, who's that? I don't know. For you Star Trek fans, remember Admiral Cartwright in the Star Trek films?
Yeah.
Also played, Benjamin Sisko's father, and he was in Soylent Green, so he's a pretty well-known genre actor, and so he did that voice. And so it's pretty cool. I mean, you look at, you know, some of these people went on to become David Paymer, you know, played played Deke, and David Paymer is a very well-known actor, done quite a lot of stuff. So anyhow, they had a really good cast of people, for the most part, doing the voices, and it's available on Audible. If you haven't signed up for Audible, you can sign up, and you can get, like, a free credit and just get this and listen to it, or if you have it, you can use it. You can one credit to get the entire series, 5 hours of Star Wars, if you like Star Wars. And, you know, it's a product of that period of time, and they used a lot of these original sound effects, original music. And some places, maybe it's a little more cheesy, you know, in some aspects, but hey, Star Wars.
5 hours of Star Wars, baby. One credit on Audible. Do it.
So that is my pick. And it's not 5 hours, Justin. It's 5 hours and 51 minutes. It's almost six hours.
Six goddamn hours of Star Wars? What the hell are you guys waiting
for? That's like four more hours of Star Wars. That's like three times episode four.
I just got my new Audible credits yesterday, and I know what I'm going to do. I have to get on a flight to Dallas tomorrow, and it's going to be Star Wars the whole goddamn way down.
And now you're probably going to be like, well, Andrew, all right. How good can this be? I mean, who would they bring in to produce such a thing? How about a guy by the name of John Madden? Not
boom,
John Madden, but John Madden, director of Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
And the most recent Best Marigold Hotel. So they got some really incredible talent in there. And you have people who, you know, have already, like Ben Burtt, you know, who does the sound design. And the sound design alone in Star Wars is fantastic. And so this is Ben Burtt given 6 hours to create this universe and world. And you're listening to this and it feels real. And there's just a lot of scenes and just it's very, what was Princess Leia up to before the Star Destroyer caught up with her? What was she doing? Where was she? What happened? What did she do to maybe get in trouble? How did she push things a little bit? What saucy things were coming out of her mouth?
Well, there we go. Now, when did this come out?
This was 1981, and they produced the other ones. They did Empire Strikes Back and Jedi as well. And I think
Empire Strikes Back is good as well. Return of the Jedi, you start to see the degradation where, like, they don't have Mark Hamill in the Return of the Jedi production, but the Empire one is fantastic.
Care to guess who played Yoda for Empire Strikes
Frank
Back?
Oz. Frank Oz, right?
In the radio drama? No.
Sonny Bono.
Nope.
Spiro Agnew.
Nope.
Abe Vigoda.
It's going to blow your mind.
Don't tell me. Don't tell me. Alan Thicke.
Close.
Who is it?
John Lithgow.
Yes!
Yeah, he nails it too.
I mean, how awesome is that?
Dude, Lithgow's a baller.
And guess who did the voice of Boba Fett in Jedi?
I don't.
In the radio drama.
Al Gore.
You are so close, you have no idea how close you are.
Typically.
He'd gone into acting and rode a bicycle everywhere.
Oh.
I don't know.
Oh, what's it called? God damn it. Ed Begley Jr.?
Yes.
Yes!
The least likely person you would ever think would do the voice of Boba Fett in the radio drama was Ed Begley Jr. This is according to Wikipedia, which could be. And there's another character. I don't remember. 9D9. I don't know what that is, and that might be something. Let me click
on
this.
Droid.
Yeah, I'm sure, but let me figure out which droid this is, because when I tell you who did that, let me see.
This is our new podcast.
Oh, that was a droid in the Jabba Hutt's palace. Okay, in the Jedi radio drama, that was voiced by Yardley Smith.
Yes, of course. The voice of Lisa Simpson.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
I think that also there is a droid that just shakes its junk in your face and goes, "Alien, alien," and that was played by Michael Fassbender.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been weird.
You want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.